Welcome to episode 135 of the OmniGamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including the Leapfrog. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uesa. How's it going, Daniel?
Good. Pretty rainy day here in Vancouver, so some cozy puzzling, like jigsaw puzzles for my kid. So, yeah, typical Vancouver day. How are you?
Yeah, I think there was actually a fog warning in town, so if you live anywhere near the water, you'll probably be hearing a bunch of fog horns go off to prevent the boats from stranding themselves on the shore, which is, you know, fantastic for light sleepers out there. I sleep through all of them, so I'm not affected.
Yeah, we still do it now, yes. Yeah, so I've got three courses of gaming topics and reviews to discuss today. We usually start off with the appetizer, where we talk about some game-related news and thoughts that have been percolating in our minds. Did you have anything to talk about this week, Mark?
No, I've been, I don't know, I've been pretty much intentionally trying to get my head out of the news. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much going on right now, I don't want to belabor the point, but there's so many horrible things going on in the news that it's hard to keep up the motivation to look for the bright, shiny spots. Not to say that there aren't any, but yeah, I want to hear what's interesting you.
Yes, yeah, in the interest of not just repeating the same topics every week, I had a couple of discussions here. Let me find that. I mean, first of all, in another new website, in independent games journalism has launched. That is Board Game Beats, launched by W. Eric Martin, who was previously the long-running news editor over at Board Game Geek. Sorry, nearly forgot the name there. Seemingly being some shakeups of the organization over at Board Game Geek, and Eric has gone and launched his own site over there, which has both news and reviews and other musings. So there's already a bunch of articles on there right now. So be sure to go and check that out if you want to support some more independent games media.
Nice. Yeah, I think Eric Martin is in a bunch of those videos that were featured on that website. So I think I could picture the face.
And a couple of other articles I've been reading this week. One of my favorite new traditions is Sunday morning is loading up the tablet and reading through the blog Critical Distance, which is itself a weekly blog that compiles blog posts from other sites, basically. Mostly video games, some tabletop sites as well, but largely independent blogs and blog posts from across the internet, most of which aren't even like paid media. It's largely just independent bloggers. A lot of those are reviews, but also a lot of critique and sort of cultural musings on games. A couple of particularly interesting articles I came across that in this week, though. The first one is called If You Ask Nicely by Autumn Wright. And that was largely about this trend in games media. I mean, it's this scale of feedback where you have a lot of these reactionaries complaining about, you know, games before they've even launched. That currently, right now, there's a big hotbed of discourse around Highguard, the new sort of, I think it's a MOBA style game. I've tried not to know too much about this. It was launched at the Game Awards. Well, there was a trailer at the Game Awards. It just launched this last week. Been a lot of discourse and people sort of seemingly excited for its inevitable failure. It did launch with a lot of negative feedback for what it looks like, but there was an article on IGN, I think, that was basically decrying all this negativity. Like, why can't we just wait for the game to come out and see what it's like? And like, sure, yes, this negativity is bad. Like, it has little value. Obviously, it's all just people trying to game the algorithm. At the same time, I think there's this real trend towards people trying to balance the scales and not quite toxic positivity, but positivity that's only really serving the interest of the publishers and the developers and just being part of the marketing apparatus of the games industry rather than actually critiquing or reviewing games. Like, what audience are you serving there and coming to the defense of these studios? It's a little strange. It's something we've seen a lot of in the board game scene, especially where it's a lot of enthusiasts who I think are largely well-meaning. We obviously all want to see our favorite game publisher or designer thrive, but I don't know, I think people can take that a little bit far and just think that is the primary role of reviewing games as to be a marketer for these games, and which I think can be a little misguided.
Yeah, there's a constant incentive to pick a side, right?
Yeah, it's like a sports team, basically. Yeah, like whether you people get invested in a game failing or succeeding, like a sports team.
Or politics. I mean, it's not going to be on us to point out the fact that the world is more polarized than ever. It seems like you can't literally just sit out and wait to see what the quality of a game is after the fact. You got to pick a side, choose a camp, and then, you know, gear up, armor up, weapon up for your to fight for your side when there really aren't any stakes, you know? Mm. Like you said, for whatever that game was, I'm not going to mention the name on purpose. It doesn't matter. The marketing department just wants you to say the name over and over and over, whether positive or negative, and that's going to lodge that game's name into the potential buyer's ear and trigger them to behave in a certain way once the game launches. That's all they want. So you're right. I'm not going to buy into that hype cycle. I feel like I have not really been on the hype cycle too much in terms of games, not for board games for a long time, not for video games for a long time. I was certainly following the hype cycle for the retro games hardware for a little while. I've kind of cooled on that. So, yeah, I don't know if I have a gene or appetite for joining in the hype cycle for games these days.
Yeah, we're ironically starting to see a lot of the video game media space really start to emulate what the board game space has looked like for years, because so many of the traditional media outlets have failed or closed or winding down in various ways. You have a lot of independent streamers and reviewers, basically it's enthusiast press, for lack of a better term, just putting their own word out there, and that again without all of the journalistic integrity. Not to say that, you know, it's all about ethics in video games journalism, don't want to open that can of worms, but I think there is a lack of consistency and standards that we really have been seeing across games media.
Yeah, that's right. That's an interesting point, because the audience is going to hear a game that we've been provided keys for later today. So you, I guess we're going to have to broach the subject of ethics policies when we're discussing a game and where we fit within that framework, because, you know, our hands aren't clean, I suppose. We're kind of wading in the waters of this game marketing space.
Look, I don't think getting a review code is, you know, unethical in any sense of the word. Only a couple of reviewers out there have like refused that entirely, which I think is noble, but like not entirely necessary. I think disclosure goes a long ways, as long as you're upfront about what's being provided by publishers, what that relationship is exactly.
Yeah, and we'll provide some more details about that in a moment. But yeah, it's hard to say where we can all stand in this marketing war. Maybe war is too polarizing a term in itself. We're just in a state of board game industry and video game industry, and it's constantly changing. I mean, just talk of the console cycle, for instance. There's talk about the PlayStation 5 generation lasting past 2028 at this point, maybe even going until 2029. Like, those are huge. That's a huge shift in the history of console generations and the industry in the past. So I think, you know, we're at a turning point. It's kind of wild waters out there, let's just say.
Yeah, look, I don't want to get too high and mighty about, like, where we're analyzing games as this precious bit of art that's enclosed in amber and completely, you know, separate from outside forces. Look, we are part of the games community infrastructure. Like, we want to be responsible for the words that we say and how we may influence people inadvertently or otherwise, but I think that's mostly it, just being self-aware of how our words affect people and like what we're trying to achieve in how we talk about games.
Yeah, it's fairly undeniable that the games industry is changing, and we just want to think about that, because you know, we have a place and a part within that, however we want to cover our games.
Amen. Okay, one other quick article I wanted to mention, just in the slightly more positive news. Another one I found on Critical Distance was called Rocket Science and Marshmallows. This is from a blogger called Leah. Both of these links I'll put in the show notes, by the way. It's largely talking about the game Outer Wilds, which I replayed at the end of last year. I haven't found a chance to talk about that in great detail, but if you've been listening for a while, you may remember that was very high on my games of all time. I think I had it at number 2. I may even be willing to bump that up following my replay. It's a game that just had so much to say about the state of existentialism, I think, and especially in times right now, we see a lot of doomerism out there. And I think Outer Wilds, what it said to me was largely how to find meaning and joy in the face of, you know, of literally in that game, the obliteration of the universe, the heat death of the universe. There is no fighting against that, but you can still find, you know, joy and meaning, even if it's as simple as a marshmallow or just your curiosity of how the universe works. But this article was comparing that to the times of today, obviously both current political events, but also, you know, COVID and the rise of AI and how there's this real dialogue about these things being inevitable and just encouraging people to roll over and just let it happen. But like, even if things are inevitable, even if it is going to happen, like that's not a reason not to fight against it, not to keep hope up. We're both parents. I think we have no choice but to be hopeful, not naively so, but always hope that there's a better world possible and that we will continue fighting for it.
For sure. I actually did have one positive thing to share. I'm just going to shout out the social media account of this individual that I've been following. They do good work. The name is Kimimi, the game eating she monster.com on Blue Sky. I follow them. And they do a bunch of retro, a lot of Japanese games, a lot of not mainstream, like a lot of kind of deep cuts.
Pretty niche novels. JRPGs and things, yeah.
Right, niche stuff. I really just get have a smile on my face whenever I see posts that they put out. So there's one positive thing. Kimimi, the game-eating she-monster, does some good work. So cheers to them and check out their account.
Yeah, I actually recently just found their account as well by way of Critical Distance. So like lots of really cool niche game writers out there. And I didn't think I mentioned, this is all written blogs. So, you know, even if it's not being monetized or like spotlighted constantly on social media, there are a lot of written blogs out there. People are doing the work if you're willing to find it.
And not only are they putting together some great written material, they actually take some attractive photography that goes along with every social media post and article that they put out. So more kudos to them for the great work.
Yep. I'll drop all those links in the show notes.
Very nice. All right. What do you think? Shall we move into the main course?
Let's hop to it.
There we go. Okay. We're going to be covering one game, the one game that we both played.
Yes, yes. We've managed to synchronize up again. As you mentioned earlier, we got some review codes. Though I will say I got those in right after I had already bought the game. That game being Big Hops.
That's right. And so I did not purchase the game, so I took advantage of the key code provided by Luckshot Games. So thank you for providing that. And, you know, we didn't provide our opinion to the publisher before releasing this episode, so you know, all our opinions are our own.
Absolutely. So yeah, this game came out just a couple of weeks ago, 12th of January 2026, for those listening in the future. And so yeah, this is the first game I'm covering from this year. We don't often cover new games, especially not since dropping Game Pass essentially, but I think in light of some of the recent discussions we've been having around AAA games and my cynicism there, I've been wanting to make a better effort to cover indie games. And especially while they're new and fresh and people are, you know, talking about them, compare and contrasting some thoughts out there. So this is our first new game covered in a little while. So yeah, I mean, Mark, do you want to give a rundown as to what this game is?
Yeah, for sure. I think it would be fairly undeniable to say that this is basically a 3D action platformer, action adventure. It's kind of a mascot 3D platformer. Mm. Now, this is a genre that I don't have a lot of experience with, a little bit, but maybe, you know, depending on your age, everyone has a favorite 3D platformer that they grew up with. Maybe it's, you know, Banjo-Kazooie, or, maybe it's like Crash Bandicoot or something like that, or Mario Galaxy, for instance, like a game that's being remastered and being put up on the big screen. So this game falls squarely within that. You play a mascot. I forget what his name is. It's something frog-like.
Hop, right? I think it's just Hop.
I know that his sister's name is
Lily. I forget. She's like only... Lilypad. Of course, right, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess the main idea is that you're a frog, so you're going to be utilizing some interesting abilities, like your tongue, to latch onto certain things, to grab items, to grab insects. Insect collecting is one aspect of this game. And you're going to be leaping and hopping around, as the name would suggest.
Yeah, so the main point of reference a lot of people seem to be comparing this to is Mario. I mean, at least some of the 3D Marios. It's going to be most people's touchstone, I think, for this sort of character platformer. Specifically, to me, that brings to mind a lot of the Nintendo 64 era. Like Banjo-Kazooie was a strong one for me. But I think more so, I think we'll discuss a little later, but more a lot of the PlayStation character platformers. So, yeah, obviously with platformers, the main draw, the main feature of this is how you move around the world. So I think that's sort of a spot to start here, and sort of what sort of move and tool set you're working with in Hop here and how that feels, because I mean that's what's going to make or break a game like this, is how fun is it to move around that world. So I mean, Hop only really has a few tools in terms of jumping. I mean, he can jump, obviously. He can, like, is your traditional crouch jump to get a little higher. You can sort of run and launch yourself to get some extra momentum. You can wall run kind of along in some areas, but a lot of what you're going to be doing is using that tongue, as you mentioned. And I think it is quite clever in how much of this game is contextualized around you using the tongue in various clever ways. You can grab collectibles and pull them towards you. You can latch onto these sort of hanging, you just find these floating orbs, basically. You can latch onto those to swing across gaps. You can lockpick with your tongue, which has these like neat little sort of puzzles, I guess, where you're trying to like, don't cross the streams. You've got to like touch all of these nodes and get to the end without crossing over. A lot of different ways that it recontextualizes your tongue. So it's a good sort of character cohesion design, I think, in this game.
Right. And additionally, those would be fairly basic ways to maneuver around the world on their own. But you also have some extraneous items that you can interact with. There's a lot of items that you can add to your inventory. There's you start with a mere 4 in inventory slots, many of which you'll want to fill with food that will replenish your health / stamina. You can save bugs for later. You can save stones that you might throw at things, various items. But the main piece of interest that you have is with the fruit trees. So there's a range of types of trees that you'll see in the environment, and they provide various fruits. So one tree will typically only provide one fruit, as you might imagine, and each of the fruits does something a little bit different. So just as an example, we'll probably go into them later, but just as one example, there's like the hot pepper tree. If you find the hot peppers that are blooming on the hot pepper tree, you can pick them, eat them, kind of scorch yourself. But you primarily, what you want to do is you want to throw them at these dry brush, and it'll start burning them. It'll set them on fire, and that will open up additional paths and additional kind of puzzles for you to navigate the world. And then there's two or three other examples I'm sure we'll get into later on.
Well, I think that's good to talk about now, because that is a core part of the tool set here. Because the movement mechanics are relatively simple, it slides you down to these various seeds that change how you're interacting with the world, essentially. Like one of the early ones you'll find is a mushroom. You throw the mushroom on the ground, it creates a bounce pad. There's the chestnuts, which will create like this vine that goes straight up. There's one that creates a rope that will shoot across a gap. And so these are all quite dynamic. Like you can throw them at any surface and they'll create a vine or a platform in various ways. And so this does really create like, it's almost a sense of like an immersive sim in how sort of open a sandbox it is, in theory at least. How often you come across these, I think, is somewhat limited. That doesn't really play to its full potential.
Yeah, they're obviously placed in very strategic places. Later on, you will come across vending machines where you can buy the fruits of your choice, and you can just add them. You can always save one in your inventory and just hold it onto it for later, which might help you in a pinch at a certain point. But there's one more, there's probably multiple more, but there's at least one more fruit that I can think of that's the bouncing fruit.
The mushrooms?
I don't know what exactly the fruit looks like. It's green, just like the rope.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. It creates the orbs that bounce back and forth. Yeah.
It creates the bouncy balls. And this was the most interesting physics-based example of a fruit. So I was in this weird tall room where I had to get above a ledge. There was no way for me to physically climb with the limited stamina that I had. There's no rope bridges that I could create. So what you did is you pulled these fruits, you threw them in the air, and they bounced opposite from whatever surface you landed them on. But they would keep going for a little while and eventually peter out. And I was thinking, oh, okay, this is a little bit interesting. It got me across a smaller gap, but the larger gap was just a little bit too far out of my reach. And I don't know if this was the same case with you, but after a few frustrating failures, I just decided to spam the heck out of the fruit, and I launched something like 30 or 40 bouncing orbs in the air, and I decided to just spam my Lickitung.
Just brute force it.
Pulling from fruit to fruit to fruit. So I was relying on chaos to just get me through, and it worked. So I think that aspect is, would you call that clever design? I don't know, but it makes for creative solutions.
It gives you the sense of being creative and playful in how you want to approach these. I did find some of those areas a bit too large, that those balls were really unpredictable. And like my only choice was to brute force it rather than being clever. Just like fill the space with balls. There's always something within reach. Because like you start to get to other more open areas that have like a lot of uneven surfaces. And so you can't really predict how they're going to bounce exactly. So you just have to either hope down to luck or, again, brute force it. And
right.
Ideally, like the thing is here, like a lot of these areas of designs, like they will give you a tool. Here's a tool you should probably use. But at the same time, you can also carry these items from previous areas. Like you can carry some of the mushrooms or the vines forward to future areas. And that gives you the sense that you'd be able to like come up with really clever solutions or like customize how you want to navigate this space. In reality, I found that those pocket slots were far too few of them, and you've at the start of the game you've got four slots and you can only carry one of each item. That is increased later in the game, but fairly late at least. And like having one mushroom that you can easily lose, like I found the chances to replenish those far too slim, that I was never really able to be particularly creative. It didn't give you enough opportunities to play within that system that it's created.
Right, but this is one element, just the fact that those fruits exist is one element that makes this game stand apart from some of those older 3D platformers that might have existed on earlier generation systems, because immediately you would think, oh, well, an old game wouldn't let me do that because it would run into memory limits. In fact, I wondered, is there a limit on how many of these bouncy fruits I can do later on? There's a tall vertical like elevator shaft, let's just say, and I had to get up there, and the only thing that they provided me was a tree that gave me the rope bridges. So of course you take a bunch of the fruit and you shoot it within the elevator shaft and you create yourself bouncing points to go up, up and up and up and up. But I made like probably 20 I used probably about 20 or so of those fruits. But what's the limit? Do I put 50? Do I put 100? Like, is there an upper limit? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it depends on your system. But, you know, this game is running on the Nintendo Switch.
And that's where we played it at least. Yep.
That's where I played it. I played it on Switch Lite, as I typically do. And it didn't run into a hardware restriction. Like I said, some of these fruits will eventually fade out. So I guess that's a way that they limit some of the memory hogging that might go on. But for the most part, it hung in there and it just let me use as many of those fruits as I wanted to.
Yeah, that wasn't necessarily an issue for me. I did come into some technical issues later, but it was impressive just how many different tools you can be playing with at once. And it is quite clever how, like, this is a game that gives you new tools to play with rather than just unlocking abilities. It's based on that tool set and items, physical items that you're picking up in the world and interacting with in like these creative ways.
Yeah, let's talk about another element that's mechanical. So two parts to this. First, in this world, you're seeking out these items. So there's a bit of a treasure hunt that you're engaging in on most of the levels. And it's for these, I don't know, I think of them as like little blueberries, but they're these little dark drops, I think they're called.
The dark drips.
Dark drips. And they're just little orbs. You can think about them as coins or whatever you want to, that are very small. And they're hidden. They're not so numerous. There's about maybe like three or four in any given direction. Usually two or three quite up high. Maybe there's just one off in this corner. Maybe there's a little grouping of two or three of them together. And there's a mechanism in which you collect them. And when you collect enough, you reach a certain threshold, and then it unlocks a kind of a reward or item that's a upgrade, essentially. And very much like a roguelike game, this isn't a roguelike game, but very much like one, it gives you a choice. It seems to be randomized between
two
different options. And on occasion, those were exactly the two same options, so I didn't have any choice. But anyways, it gives you the option to collect these randomized gems. I think they're called trinkets, and they act very much like the trinkets from Hollow Knight, Silk Song.
The badge system, basically,
Yeah, badges, very much like that Prince of Persia Lost Crown that I have a very positive feelings for, very much like that. And I think you're limited to only two or three badge slots, trinket slots at the beginning, but you can also quite easily
earn
additional slots. So that's a mechanism that I was quite surprised to find in a 3D platformer. It gives the game quite a bit more customization options than I expected from a 3D platformer. Maybe I just haven't kept up with the trends of it, but that was, you know, pleasant to see. Customization options.
It is a really nice touch too, how those badges are like physically on your backpack. You can basically sticker them onto your backpack. They're quite small. You can't really make out much detail, but it's a cute thematic touch. The actual how they work, what those badges do, a lot of them are like give you extra health or give you extra spaces in your backpack, which is very useful. A lot of them aren't quite as interesting. They feel a bit more like accessibility options. They're not really changing the fundamental way that you interact with the game. They're just like fairly incrementally increasing your abilities.
One of them that I thought was pretty interesting was, well, it was the most out of character one. Like you said, most of them were pretty basic. But one of them was, it fills every slot, which means you can only have that one trinket enabled. But if you do have it enabled, you don't take damage, which is pretty impressive in this game. This game, from what I've seen, doesn't really have like enemies. Like there's no Goombas running around. There's no cactuses, pokies, you know, just kind of getting in your way. Most of the damage you take is from, you know, running into hazards. So you'll run into fire, like I mentioned previously, or just literally just from falling. Like if you fall into an empty pit, then it's going to steal half a heart or half a stamina or whatever you might call it. Most of the damage you earn is from the environment, not enemies per se. So it's actually quite frustrating to fail a lot of times at doing this kind of tricky platforming run. There's these optional kind of platforming challenges to get more of those dark drips. And like I said, they are optional. But if you fail two or three or four times early on, then all your stamina is gone. Maybe you find food along the way and you build up your stamina. But maybe you use all the food in your backpack and then you keep on failing. And what's the result? You just have to respawn at the beginning. So that's frustrated. And that tool, the trinket that doesn't give you any damage, could let you continue as many times as you want to. So I thought that was interesting.
that's the sort of thing I was saying could have just been an accessibility option, really, especially when it precludes you from using some of the other more interesting ones, like expanding your backpack or giving you more options to play in that sandbox. So I think limiting that to like that's the only one you get to have is a little restrictive. It could have just been one of the accessibility menus somewhere.
It's true, but you don't have to use that all the time, right? You can just enable it when you want to take on a particular run. So I think it does give you options, not as much as just a menu toggle, but sometimes players don't want to change the difficulty, right? They want to, I want to win, you know, I want to get good and win the hardcore way using all the tools that are available to me. And that's one way you could do that.
That said, I mean, as you mentioned, there are no enemies in this game, which I think is quite novel, that it's based entirely around just the platforming and getting from A to B and all the various collectibles in a level. I think that is a novel way, rather than having the attacks and various ways you're interacting with enemies being the primary way you're interacting. It's largely about traversal, is the various tool sets that you're going to be getting.
Yeah, it made me think about, you know, what the role of those enemies play in the world. And obviously, when you roll it all the way back to things like, you know, Super Mario 1 or Super Mario 64, you think, oh, well, those are just to make you lose lives. You lose enough lives, it's game over. But nowadays, it's not really about lives anymore. I don't think even Mario games have lives any longer. But they also serve to make the world feel alive. So in something like Mario Galaxy or Mario Odyssey, you know, the enemies are not necessarily there to pose a hazard. They are, I suppose, mildly. But, you know, quite literally in the Mario universe, the enemies are characters that enliven the world and make it, you know, feel delightful and not empty. And in this world, quite often, one of the early areas that you go to is a big, vast desert with these, you know, large dramatic landscapes and empty canyons and things like that. And you can imagine yourself there, nothing around you. It's quite desolate. You can yell out probably, and you would hear the echo if it was a real environment. And there's nothing around, and it just kind of feels lifeless because it is. So in a sense, I sort of wish that there were, you know, more signs of life, as in creatures in the environment, not really to pose hazards per se, but just to make the world feel more lived in and I guess a little bit more alive and delightful.
Some of the later areas do feel more populated. Each main world has a town, but some of the other side areas also have a lot of people populating it that will just you can talk to and we'll provide commentary. There are a lot of those empty areas, but I think that's a good pivot to talk about some of the level design and wider structure of the game. I mean, to my mind, platforming games like this have fit somewhere on a spectrum. On one end, you have your Super Mario Brothers, your Donkey Kong Country. Those mostly traditional 2D games that are largely about get from A to B, like fairly linear progression. It's just about getting to the end of the level. The other end of the spectrum, you have your more open world sandboxy games, your Banjo-Kazooie, your Mario Odyssey, Donkey Kong Bonanza, that are largely about collectathons. Even if there are objectives or primary objectives within a level, it's largely fairly open and permissive, and then you explore and get a bunch of collectibles and... like, I think I've discussed this before, like where you've got Mario 64, which will only have one primary goal in a level, one star. Like, you load into each star. You can't just go in and get any star you want. You pick which star you're going to get, and the world is designed around getting just that one star. Versus later ones will have, like, is 50 stars scattered across this whole world. I think Big Hops fit somewhere in the middle. And I think, like, Mario 64 is probably the closest comparison. But to me, I think the biggest comparison is more some of the PlayStation character platformers, which I didn't play a lot of, but from my experience, some of your, like, Sly Coopers and Jak and Daxters, they're a little more linear, a little more, like character and story focused. Like, you have a bigger sense of momentum, I guess, for better or worse. You're moving from A to B. Largely in this game is a linear level. There are some more open areas, but you're largely just getting to the end of this area to get a main objective and then quickly moving on to the next one. There's very little backtracking, or zero backtracking, largely, other than a couple of, like, you're going back to a town once or twice. But it's largely constantly moving forward to the next area.
Yeah, there's definitely like missable elements, which is not to say it's directly a linear path. You can meander quite a bit, you can search quite a bit, and like we said, there are those optional elements that are available there. They're clearly signposted. We failed to mention that there's this sort of guide-like character that you meet fairly early on. So you have Hop, you have Lily early on, who's kind of your tutorial quest giver really at the beginning, and then eventually you meet this kind of purple guy that poofs out of thin air, and he's kind of your guide slash narrator, who kind of prods you on and gives you missions and this and that, and
this is his name, to be clear.
This he's kind of hanging around these kind of purple splotches peppered throughout the world, and those purple splotches either will contain the kind of treasure boxes where you'll unlock some of those rewards for earning the dark drips, or there'll be these kind of like portals that will allow you to enter an optional side realm.
A challenge room.
Objective, is to win a larger dark orb or something to that effect. I don't know what the exact term is, but it's kind of interesting. This game, I thought, was pretty straightforward, linear, and fairly dull for a while until that character Dis, I'm not going to spoil it, but they kind of have shakes things up, let's just say, and takes you to this very kind of non-conventional, like, gravity warping world, which I thought, oh, okay, this is different. This is doing things that are slightly less conventional, slightly less kind of grounded in typical character mascot platformers that I'm familiar with. Kind of reminded me of those kind of dark otherworldly areas in, say, like a Dishonored or something like that, where the environment is kind of like shifting around you and you don't really know what's real.
It's outside of reality.
I actually liked that and said, oh, okay, now I'm starting to pay attention a little bit. And from there on, the world opens up. So I encourage you, if anyone's kind of on the fence about this game, to definitely at least play until you're past that. Don't worry, it's fairly early in the gameplay. And then they start to expand the rules, and then they give you a lot more tools, and the platforming kind of does kind of cycle back a little bit and get it a little bit more grounded. But there's more variety, let's just say, in the challenge that they provide.
Yeah, I mean, each level you're largely doing pretty different mechanics in terms of how you're activating various platforms or traversing these spaces. There's like one with a stealth section, which might frustrate some people, but it is changing level to level how you're interacting with the world, for better or worse. Those gravity-defying levels, I think, are really cool. They remind you of something like Mario Galaxy, where it's bending around a space, like walking on all sides of a sphere, basically. I think it's a little... It's just enough to leave you wanting more. That it leaves the other levels a little more wanting, I think. Especially how linear they are, in short.
This game, I mean, it's... introduces a lot of disparate elements. Obviously, its influences are showing, but I think that's generally a good thing, because I think the platforming could get pretty dull if it was just kind of linear objective to linear objective. They seem to vary the variety of challenges, kind of play with some verticality at some point. And then, I don't know, there's this kind of wider open area, and then there's the big town, which introduces some more narrative elements, some more characters, and then it goes into this kind of underground area, which provides its own challenges, like water, for instance. So they do tend to mix things up, and I think that's really good for pacing, because I don't know about you, but I tend to get a little tired of platformers after a while, and kind of I don't want to be doing the same stuff all the time. And this game does provide additional things every now and again, like puzzles, the more aforementioned puzzles. You mentioned the lock picking. And then there's just kind of like lever puzzles. There's door locking button puzzles, electrical switches, electrified fences, things like that. And then the sentries, like the Metal Gear Solid style stealthing elements there, which... I feel like none of it is too none of it is too intense that will frustrate you to the nth degree, but I don't know. It's going to vary per person. I certainly got frustrated at points, and there are points where, you know, there's only one path to go forward, and that might frustrate some people.
Well, that's, I think, primarily my issue with this game, is that like these levels are very linear. I think it's the game gives you a moveset and a toolset that feels very permissive and open-ended that don't really jive with the level design. Both the restriction of how many tools you can carry with you at a time and the levels being very linear and how you can approach them, I don't think really rewards the toolset that the game gives you. I don't think those are in conversation with each other in a particularly interesting way. The levels were designed as a puzzle platformer to like figure out a very specific way through them, which doesn't allow the permissive elements to really express themselves properly, I don't think. Especially with how rarely, as I said, you can replenish those tools. You can buy like seeds and pots. There's this whole system for like buying more seeds, but you only come across those towns like two or three times, and he's only got like four slots in your bag. So I wasn't really able to make the most of that. I don't think it didn't really feel like a cohesive design philosophy behind how these systems are interacting, to be honest.
Yeah, and there are these sort of vendors in the town, the one central town that I visited. And it was interesting because I reached that point, I got to the vendors, I didn't have a lot of money because I guess I wasn't collecting a lot, I wasn't focusing on a lot. And then later on, after I'd left that town, I realized that I could bust open these crates and find coins in them. Crates, barrels, the typical little stuff that you find peppered around levels. And I don't know that it wasn't signposted, but I started collecting a lot of money after I left the town. And then I eventually reached a limit. It's like, you can only hold 200 coins.
200 coins, yeah.
I guess it's like the Zelda Link kind of artificial rupee limit, right? Like, you could be a rupee millionaire if they let you, but there's like a limit to your wallet size, so you can only hold so many. But there's no like fast travel back to the town, right? Like, I can't go back to the town. So like, why am I collecting this money? Or why didn't they tell me that I needed to do that earlier on? Like, they just could have told me from the very first moments that I needed to be collecting this stuff so I would have it when I need it. And then I only got the money after I needed it. So that was a little bit frustrating. But I suppose if I went back to it, I could, when I return to town eventually, I can drop some cash there. And that might give me a few more tools at my disposal. But I think the money is primarily for like cosmetics and things like that, right?
You can buy costumes and things. Yeah, those whole collectibles I didn't find particularly interesting. Like, you can find petals that you use for like dyeing your clothes, but I like very quickly had maxed out those. The coins, you could buy some costumes that were fairly they're cute, and you could get hats. Ended up losing my hats. Like, they literally just fall off sometimes, and
right.
you have to go back to the shop again and buy them again. I don't know.
Yeah, that was one of the saddest moments, is when I lost my I think there was like a Little Kitty Big City hat or something like that.
Yes,
I don't know if it's an officially licensed Little Kitty Big City hat, but it looked like the cat from Little City, so I was really sad when I lost it. It just kind of like tumbled off a platform, and then I couldn't recover it again. So
it's a strange choice.
That was like the saddest moment. Yeah, that was frustrating, certainly. Yeah, should we cover more beyond the basics, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing to cover here is the writing. Perhaps. I think the first big surprise for me that I quite enjoyed was that this has voice acting. I think I've played a lot of games, Little Kitty, Big Cities, a lot of like family-friendly, bright, colorful character platformers that my daughter loves the look of, and then they don't have voice acting. So then I have to like narrate every character and all the text throughout the game. And so to see this actually had voice performances was impressive. And it's all pretty good voice performances. I think it's pretty strong. It's all like fairly understated and fairly down to earth character performances. They're not like really wacky over the top. I think it's quite grounded in a quite genuine way. I thought generally the writing was quite solid.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the understated voice performances were just right, not over the top to be the point of annoying, but not so animated to be like a Saturday morning cartoon or anything like that. Yeah, I think the writing is fairly, like, adequate. It's just, like, not too great, not too, but not too terrible either. Like, there was a couple of good jokes in there. It was fairly kind of, like, dry humor, I sort of feel like. It's just, like, really mild, and I think the mild voice acting really kind of is just right for it. I thought most of the characters were fairly forgettable. Other than Dis, whose name I forgot, but I remember the character fairly well. And there's a couple you meet here and there. There's this kind of cowgirl lady boss, kind of Ma Baker sort of lady called Jolene. And she's got a lot of dialogue written for her, which I had to listen to a couple of times repeatedly.
Surprisingly wordy. Reasons.
Yeah. So there is a lot of writing where it comes in handy, but most of it's fairly forgettable. Like, I think there's like this like engineer guy that you meet fairly early on, and then you just leave, and then I just
the pacing forgot. Is a little weird with the way characters come and go. Yeah, the weird thing to me though is that it just drops a bunch of like surprising swear words, which like I'm not being a Puritan, I don't care at swear words, but it just feels very tonally inconsistent with the rest of this sort of bright, colorful family game. So that was a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I don't really remember where that came up, or maybe they were just so mild that I didn't really think much.
I think it's Jolene, largely, and a couple towards the end.
Okay.
But the other thing is
pulling his punches.
The other thing is that I think by the end, a bit of like cynical mean-spiritedness started to sneak into this game in ways that didn't really sit well with me, and some of the characters being quite mean to each other. Most weird of all is the middle section. One of the characters is like an oil magnet, and like there's an eco-terrorist and who's like gone too far, and you have to try and stop him, and the oil magnate is like trying to be sympathetic, and it's like, you don't need to be sympathetic for the oil magnet. Like, I don't know. I feel like it was trying to be nuanced, but I don't think that that's necessary. It's like, we have to... I don't think you have to give it to the big oil companies.
There you go. There's some interesting choices in this game, for sure. I have a complaint to say, if it's all right. So, I didn't want this to color the rest of my opinions about this game, because I think there's, you know, generally good in this game. And there's generally things that are delightful. Platform fans are really get some enjoyment out of this game, I think. I'm not a platform fan, but I don't think that too much colored my opinion of this game. I know platformers exist, and they're popular for a bunch of different people. Now, my complaint with this game is that it's quite buggy. And like you said, this game is only a few weeks old at this point in early 2026. So maybe these issues are going to get resolved. But I ran into a couple of bugs that were pretty undeniable, noticeable, and for me, game-breaking. So first off, the game takes a terribly long time to load initially, and so much so that I thought something was broken. Eventually, the game did load, and it runs, and it chugs at a few points, but not too strange for a Nintendo Switch game. It's an old system. But there is a certain point I reached in the game where I could not continue because of various catastrophic failures. So this game doesn't let you have multiple saves, to my knowledge. It only auto-saves at key points. I played a game session, I went to bed, I came back the same night, and then I was in an area where there's a locked door. So I walk past the door, and then the lock is on the door. I had unlocked it the previous night. So the door is open, but the lock is floating in the middle of the door frame, and I cannot walk through it, but I can see through the door. So that was my first tip off. And then there's a moment where I turn a corner, and then the quest giver is following behind me. They're not there. They were there the first time. And then there's a sequence where I go through this sort of heating vents, and then I have to spy on these characters. And then those characters talk, and they talk repeatedly, and then I'm not able to record them, which is the quest trigger. And typically when there are quests, you see like the little, you know, the little helper text on the top right corner or something like
objectives,
that.
Objectives, yeah.
The objectives are not showing in the top right corner for me. So somewhere in all of that jumble, several things broke down, and I just am not able to continue that part of the quest. I wouldn't complain too much about this, except that that literally stopped me from playing this game when I wanted to keep playing it more. And I tested this on 3 different Nintendo Switches. Switch regular, a Switch Lite, and a Switch 2. So I don't think it was just like memory loading or something like that. The save file was just broken. So I'm afraid that if you spent your money on this, you might run into a similar problem, at least at this point, until they patch a fix.
Yeah, I was playing some Switch 2. The Switch version is reportedly performing a lot worse than the Steam version. The developer has owned up to that. Patches are coming. I generally don't hold technical issues to a game. I usually have the presumption that it will be fixed sooner or later. That like and performance isn't a high priority for me. That said, I also did have some game-breaking bugs fairly late in the game. I had a sequence that just crashed. The game just crashed entirely like twice in a row. I waited till it got patched literally last night. I was finally able to get through, but it's like somehow catapulted me past where I was, and so I missed out that entire like cutscene. So I don't know what happened. I just woke up in jail suddenly. And so yeah, that was a little disappointing. Like, assumingly when you're listening to this, it will be better. The Steam version is more stable apparently, but that it might be a factor for me.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that specifically because I can only review the game now, right? Like, this is when I reviewed it. I can't review it for some possible future that is unknown to me. So that's the current state of it now. Just take that with a grain of salt, that it's not running great on Nintendo Switch Original at this point. Otherwise, I enjoyed what I played. I played up to that point, kind of through past the sewers, I guess you would call it. And I fairly pleasant, some nice challenges, platforming challenges, not blowing me away in any particular way, but, you know, adequate, fun platforming.
As more of a platforming fan, I'm a little more jaded on this, perhaps. It feels a little more uninspired. I think, as I said, the movement mechanics and the level design don't really work in conjunction with each other, I don't think. And for one, the physics, I don't think, just works very well. Like, so much of the game feels like it's requires this real sweet point of momentum. Like, when you're making these swings across these gaps, I'd grab hold of the ball with my tongue and then literally be left hanging because I didn't have enough momentum. And I can't, even if I swing back and forth, I still don't have enough momentum. You have to like hit it with enough momentum and then release at the exact sweet point to keep going. And like, there's wall runs that sometimes work and sometimes don't and just drop you into the chasm. And like, I found it really unreliable as to getting these mechanics to fire off properly.
I have no idea why forward jumping requires a 2-button sequence. Like, why isn't running forward, jumping forward, just press forward and press a jump button? I don't understand that with this game. And for some reason, when you tongue and latch onto a latch point, like you said, when you lose momentum and you have to swing, you swing from side to side rather than forward, head over heels, which makes the targeting of where you're going to release from the swinging very, very difficult. This game is, you have to fight against the game even when you know what steps you need to take next. You have to fight against the
controls. It should be fairly straightforward.
Yeah, so there are definitely some bummers.
Look, I just said this game was uninspired. I take that back. Look, I think this game does have some excellent ideas. Like, especially with the tool set, I just don't think it's built a system that allows you to play with those tools as much as you should.
Yep, maybe this dish of frog legs should have cooked a little bit longer. Let's just say that. That's big hops for Switch and Steam. All right, what do you think, Daniel? Should we move on to our dessert sequence?
Yeah, we jump to dessert. We talk about some non-gaming media that we've been enjoying. As we've said, other forms of media can be in conversation with games and broaden our appreciation in many ways. And so we'd like to talk about something else that we've been enjoying. Mark, what have you been enjoying?
Yeah, I would extemporaneously talk about the ecoterrorism-themed book that I am reading right now, but I'm not prepared to yet. I'm just part of the way through it. Just you mentioned ecoterrorism. I thought that was an interesting coincidence. But let me talk about a book that I read slightly earlier. I've been reading the manga called Blame. This is not a brand new manga or anything like that, but it's very interesting. It's by an author called Tsutomu Nihei. And this individual is responsible for some other series that you might be familiar with. Some people might be familiar with. They wrote Knights of Sidonia, which has turned into an animated series.
The Muse song, I think?
Possibly. It's on Netflix, I believe. At least a couple seasons are. And the manga also called Apossims. Apossims, APOSIMZ. I haven't read that one. But Blame, I have read. And boy, let me tell you, this is a really good one. I've read the first two volumes. I read the first volume a long time ago, and the second volume more recently. It is available in the Kobo Unlimited plan if anyone's interested to try out a trial of that. A bunch of volumes are on there. This is in the science fiction vein, but it's in the science fiction mold that I really like. So this isn't like cyberpunk or some near future stuff. This is like way far flung future where you don't know when it is and you don't know what's going on. And that's a genre I really like. It kind of reminds me of the far flung future of Numenera. I mentioned that before in the Torment Tides of Numenera video game cover. But Numenera, of course, is based on the first Cypher System TTRPG from Monte Cook Games that takes place in the far-flung future where you don't know what time it is and you don't know what the rules are. So basically you follow this character. It's taking place on Earth, but the Earth is like really weird. Basically this one character, I don't even remember what their name is. I think it's something, oh yeah, Kiri. Kiri is their name. And they're the typical kind of surly looking whatever medium height Japanese protagonist that most manga have. And he's just climbing. He's just climbing up the spire. And he's climbing up and he's climbing up and you don't really know why. He's got some sort of like mission that he's on where he has to find the net terminal gene. I don't know what this is, but it's important to him. And he has a big ass, it's a small gun. It's a small handgun, but it shoots like a massive, like earth shattering beam out of it. So much so that like he can't pull it out all the time because like he could literally destroy the building he's in with one shot of it. So that part of it is cool. It's called a graviton beam emitter. And he's on a mission to go up and up and up and kind of like, say, Slay the Spire or something like that. Every time he goes up, he's not like in, sometimes he's in a tower, but he's sort of like moving up like tiers of the world. So much so, and the tiers are so big that you can look around you for miles and miles and miles, and you're still within a structure. But you can't see the ceiling.
It's like the world tree or something, I think it's tiered, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like you're in a Dyson sphere or something like that. And like the rules of each of the tiers are slightly different, kind of gives you the Snowpiercer vibes, where every section is kind of branched off of each other, and culture has diverged and society has diverged, and there's these kind of like mechanical like hunter beings, mechanical beings of all kinds. There are these mechanical beings that are fairly like neutral. They just are these massive giants that go around and like build and maintain the structure, but people have lost the knowledge of why or how they operate. It's just like effed up sci-fi stuff, and it just goes on this kind of like fruitless mission, and lots of action happens. You meet some characters that do go in unexpected directions, and the art is good, but I should say that the art is interesting in the way that it's very like sketchy, like literally sketchy. Like it looks like a lot of impressionistic pencil drawing, but it's still very captivating. Like the worlds seem like there could be universes out there beyond what's depicted in the panel. Reminds me a lot of like the original Otomo's Akira manga, reminds me a lot of that. Reminds me of Masamune Shiro's work, like Appleseed, or Miyazaki's original Nausicaa manga. Has these kind of like sketchy depictions of massive worlds at a grand scale that just kind of sort of blows the mind. So Blame
gives you a sense of a much bigger world out there beyond what you're seeing, right?
That's right. Like, that's what I like out of sci-fi and fantasy, to be honest, is something that literally blows my mind. I don't go to sci-fi or fantasy to see the same old stuff that I got from every other sci-fi or fantasy. Otherwise, why would I be reading them? You know, I don't go to them because they're my comfort genre. I want my mind blown. This one, it does that while still providing, you know, a lot of manga style action that you might come to expect from that. So it's just so intense that I can't even read it like back to back to back. I just like need some months in between volumes to kind of like reset myself. So I'm still on volume 2. I finished volume 2, but I'll gladly read volume 3 in the future. And I don't know how many volumes there are, but each of them is very powerful. Really kind of just feels epic, and not too many series of any genre truly feel that way to me. So this is the manga called Blame by Tsutomu Nihei, and I think it's by Kodansha Publishing. Go get it. It's in the Kobo app, or presumably in paperback as well.
Awesome. Speaking of mind-blowing fantasy, I've been reading a novel called The Works of Vermin by Hieron Enns, I think it's pronounced, E-N-N-E-S. And so this is, I mean, it fits pretty firmly into sort of this weird subgenre that I've been compelled by, called weird fiction. That's sort of somewhat adjacent to fantasy and horror. I think things like Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation, or China Mayville's Perdido Street Station. So this is set in this fantasy city. It's sort of industrial, where they don't exactly have electricity, but they have cars and telephones. So it's sort of semi-modern, but there's no sense of like global infrastructure. It's all set within this one city that's all inside a giant decaying tree stump. Now, it's an incredibly stratified city. You've got your traditional, your over-city, your under-city that's down in the roots. So it's very much like, your Final Fantasy VII, where the social stratification is very much, you know, manifest in reality. And a lot of the depravity of the upper classes also manifested in reality with, like, weird body modifications and grotesquerie, and everything's just decaying and falling apart constantly. You've got giant bugs running around, like hallucinatory moths and giant rats, and it's half of the story is from the perspective of an exterminator, like tracking down these bugs and coming across this sort of reality bending centipede, basically, that's sort of driving the story forward. And the other half is like this, basically in the aftermath of a revolution. And like the only thing that's predictable in this world is like the revolutions are going to keep happening like clockwork, basically, because like time for another tyrant to depose the old tyrant, basically. And so it's very messy and hard to know exactly what's happening in this world. Like the closer you look at it, the more it just sort of rides out of your understanding. And it's very weird in all the definitions of that word that I just found really mind-blowing and just intriguing. And is a fascinating, it's not exactly a twist, but something happens later on that just recontextualizes everything that you've read in this really incredible way. It is very flowery language that can be tough to get a read on sometimes, but I just found it incredibly captivating. It's very deep down the sort of the fantasy horror sort of biopunk rabbit hole, but I found it incredibly refreshing. Probably retroactively my favorite book from last year, I think.
Nice. Well, I am glad to hear of another sci-fi recommendation. Glad, I know that you're a big sci-fi fan, so it's nice to hear that this was impressive to you. Yeah, we aligned once again on our theme and general subject matter this episode with our reviews. So I'll add The Works of Vermin to my list.
Excellent. Okay, well, if you have any questions or comments on today's topics, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can follow me on Blue Sky at MARKYUASA at bskysocial.com. And Daniel, where can people find you?
You can find me at Board Game Feast, also on Blue Sky, and the OmniGamers Club account there as well.
Great. And also check out, my cat is digging through my piles of papers, so don't mind that. Also check out our episodes in video form as well. We post videos on YouTube of all the episodes that go out. Please like and subscribe and share those with people you think might enjoy them. And of course, if you want to listen to our episodes in audio form, we're in a podcatcher of your choosing. All of our oldest episodes are only in audio form, so if you want to seek those out, I like to think our episodes are timeless. Go check them out there on a podcatcher of your choosing. And really, any feedback.
Most of our games are not new releases.
There you go. They're rarely ever, so this is one of our rare ones. But, you know, we get to games when we get to them. And we love to hear from you, whether you've played the games we've been playing or if you have an idea for one to cover in the future.
One quick plug, I'm continuing to put out written reviews from games that we haven't had time to cover on the podcast here. This last week, I put out one for the Talos Principle 2, the puzzle philosophy game. In short, I think it's a little too obsessed with the philosophy and just asking questions for the sake of asking questions rather than having anything interesting to say, that really gets in the way of the actual puzzles. So go and check that out. I'll put the link in the show notes.
Cool. I've been meaning to get around to the Talos Principle. That's what it's called, right? Talos Principle. So I'm looking forward.
Well, the first one was really good, I think, but the second one did not impress.
Nice. Well, first one I have to hit, so there we go. All right, Daniel, shall we leave it there? And we'll catch you all in the future.
And remember to have a balanced diet of games. Thanks.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.